Hello and welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Sandy Hunt, a member of the Personal Growth Forum and your chair today. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite you to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is a pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Fred Luskin, addressing how to forgive for good. Dr. Luskin has had a remarkable career as a researcher, writer, professor, and practitioner in the field of forgiveness, locally and worldwide. His books, articles, speaking engagements, workshops, podcasts, videos, and his directorship of the Stanford Forgiveness Project have given him the exposure to make him a household name in the field of forgiveness. I am personally honored to introduce Dr. Luskin this evening. As a mental health professional for over 30 years, I attended hundreds of hours of continuing education classes. The 8 hours I spent with Dr. Luskin were most valuable to me, personally and as a professional psychotherapist. I'm confident that we will leave tonight with some insight and some practical solutions to whatever ails us. I asked Dr. Luskin what he wanted me to include in the introduction. His response says it all. His comment, "The only meaningful introduction is that I have been lucky enough to help some people." Would you please help me welcome Dr. Fred Luskin?
Is that good?
Well, hi.
Do you want me to stand here?
Yep.
Okay.
Hello, everyone. I never know what to be introduced as. People introduce me as like somebody from Stanford, and I think, well, okay, that's nice. But I mean, for good or for bad, I decided to teach forgiveness to make a little contribution to the world, and that's just true. And it's a contribution we can all make, just by being a nicer person. You know, today I was finishing up a class that I teach on couples therapy. And I was reading the research on what is it that makes couples get along. And you'd be shocked to realize that mostly it's, are they nice to each other? And I think the same thing about forgiveness or all these other fancy things that you bring experts like me in to talk about. I don't know, a good kindergarten teacher could probably do the same to remind you. But you'll be shocked if you, in couples work or in couples, what makes them get along is if they say more nice things to each other than hostile things. That's a deep insight. If they have the capacity to repair the damage that they've done. So, I'm sorry. Can I make it right? Do they have the capacity to calm themselves down? These all relate to forgiveness, which is why I'm bringing it up. Can you calm yourself down when you've gotten uncalm? Now, what I'm trying to do is present this, that there's no expert up here. There's simply human questions that human beings have tried to figure out how to answer as long as human beings have been on the planet. And most of the answers involve on things that matter, developing your character, being kind where you can, try to be generous, and learn some self-control. And most of the deeper questions, those have a lot of power as part of. So sometimes people make me an expert to make it so that it's not available to everybody. You know, oh, here's the Stanford expert, and his work has been all over the world, and, you know, he's taken to, you know, terrible places and helped heal people. And that's true, but if somebody that you live with says something unkind to you, and you take a deep breath and remember when they were kind, and you don't respond harshly, then you've contributed as much as I have. It's that simple. You've done your piece, I do mine. But the world, that's what it craves. It craves more of us being kind, of not repaying harshness with harshness. I mean, there's something very ironic about, again, and I'm very, I guess, proud of the work that I've done, but it's all I've done is take very simple ideas and remind people of things they already know. So think about that. Like, what is it, what very, very, very simple offense could I release? Because there's dozens of them. But just for a moment, think of one. You know, where are you holding on in a way that's not needed? Where do you find yourself saying unkind things about other human beings? Those are the places for forgiveness. You don't have to have a child murdered or have a kid killed at the World Trade Center or any of the other things that we've done, or bring people in from Sierra Leone or Northern Ireland or deal with people from the Middle East. You could have somebody who said a harsh word to you, and you're paying that harsh word forward by saying harsh words about them. Well, that's your moment. And that's, you know, that's the forgiveness question. That's the decency question. That we all have the same question. You know, for some people, the provocation is higher. You know, and I'm not going to say, having done work with people whose children were murdered, I'm not going to say that that's not more challenging. But the good news is that when those people fail at it, they're probably, at some level, if there's a forgiveness, more forgivable than you are when you fail at the little things that we fail at all the time, the harsh words that come out of our mouth, the unnecessary continuation of offense. You know, these are just endless human questions of what do we do when other people disappoint us or hurt us or let us down or don't behave in the way we think they should. What do we do when we fail or don't behave in the way we think we should? I mean, these are daily questions. These are the questions that either poison or make one's home a good place to be. You know, forgiveness, again, I've taught in the worst of circumstances. I mean, I don't mean like, you know, the environments, but with people who have been harmed by the worst of circumstances. And some of that is just, like, I can't believe some of the ways that this world is harsh and unkind and vicious. And yet, I've also taught in rooms full of people who have issues like my brother-in-law didn't invite me to his kid's wedding 3 years ago. And I'm still speaking bad about my brother-in-law, right? Or anybody over the age of 40 who's still speaking badly about their parents. You know, it's like that's just done. So what I'm getting at is there's so many ways to think about forgiving. You know, forgiving yourself, forgiving others, forgiving life for being so unbelievably difficult. You know, there's a very essential difficulty to this life. You know, I've joked in many places, even if your life goes absolutely perfectly, like one day you just wake up dead. You know what I mean? Like, even if everything goes swimmingly, you know, everybody loves you, you win the Nobel Prize, you get an Oscar, you know what I'm saying? People walk up to you and tell you you're beautiful on the street, they invite you to wealthy homes. Even if everything goes well, you wake up dead one day. And so life itself is a very significant challenge. And so there is a basic, like, either resentment or forgiveness that each of us has to decide in our very orientation to this life. I mean, you don't even have to wait for your brother-in-law to not invite you to his kid's wedding, because lots of stuff is going to have happened before then. It's built into the fabric of this life. It's just built in. This is not a place where it's all going to work out for any of us. And so what the forgiveness question is how do we deal with the ways that it didn't work out for us? Not that it's unusual that things didn't work out, but that it didn't work out for us in a particular way. Like, it doesn't work out for everybody at some point. You know, at some point, you get a medical diagnosis to which there is no cure. At some point, somebody decides that they don't love you. At some point, that happens to everybody. At some point, you will fail in something. That's guaranteed. So how do we prepare for that? Like, these are not unusual experiences. That's the thing that I used to have to stifle some laughter with. and I wasn't always good at it, because people would come into some of the classes that I was teaching and act like shocked. Like, my wife, she left me. Now, and I'm not saying I'm advertising for people's wives to leave them. But I thought to myself, and again, there's some data about this, well, you probably weren't getting along. You know what I mean? Like, okay, let's just think this through. Like, did you have a good relationship? Were you kind to her? Did she give you any signs, you know what I mean? Like, forwarding her mail 3 months early or changing the locks on the door, like little subtle clues. Or sleeping in a different room or not having sex with you for 2 years or whatever it is. But shocked, just shocked. And then I would think to myself, what planet do these people live on? Like, shocked that painful things happen. And I think to myself, did you live in one of those game show isolation booths? You know what I mean? Where they shut off all the external world so you can't get reached by any stimuli. Otherwise, you can't be shocked that painful things happen. Like, if you've ever read a newspaper, ever watched TV, ever passed a hospital, you would get stimuli that would suggest that difficult things happen here. So the only shock is that you didn't prepare yourself for the possibility that it might happen to you. Now, there is some very humorous data on couples, which is that 25% of men claim that they had no idea their partner was unhappy. That level of cluelessness is something to really honor. No, seriously, like, you really have to give credit where credit is due. You know what I'm saying? Like, I can see one person who's had, like, a stroke, you know, he doesn't get that the partner's, like, not happy. But 25% of men whose wives leave claim to not have a clue. And I'm thinking, if that's true, how did the wife stay? Like, how could you stay with somebody that clueless at all? Like, you get them that they have no pulse, and then you leave. But this is all of us. Oh my God, you mean you lied? Well, everybody lies. Everybody. In different ways. I lied this morning. It was an interesting experience. I lied a little bit. No, you'll really get a kick out of this. And then I was like going like this to myself. So the woman that I'm with, I was in her home this morning, and she had a nutrient bar on her shelf that I had given her. Okay. So I noticed that I had given her like a month ago, and she hadn't eaten it. So I'm in her house this morning, and I take the nutrient bar, and I eat it in my car. And then she texts me like a few hours later, where's my nutrient bar? And my first response was, I'm not going to tell her. Because then I'll be embarrassed and she'll say, why'd you take my nutrient bar? Are you an Indian giver? You know what I mean? Like she'd have this is what my mind was doing. Like all the grief that I'm going to have to go through if I simply admit I filched the Indian bar. So she sent me a text, like, I can't find my Indian, in my nutrient bar, you know, and I'm thinking, what do you do? Because I didn't want to face the negativity or even the perceived negativity. So I sat there and I sat there and then I bought myself some time. So what happened to your nutrient bar? She said, I don't know, it had right here. So then I decided, okay, Fred, you got to stop this. So this is where I half lied. I called her up and I said, I took your bar. And she said, well, why? And I gave her half the reason, which was, well, it hadn't been eaten, and I wanted to look at it because I didn't know what was in it, which was true. It's one of the reasons why I walked outside with it. But then I didn't tell her that, by the way, not only did I check out the ingredients, but I gobbled it down. Okay, so I didn't finish that piece, and then I felt terrible because, you know, here's somebody I'm with. Why am I lying to them? So I met her again on the way to San Francisco, and what I did was I went to Whole Foods and bought another nutrient bar, which I handed to her and said, well, I ate the other bar. And she didn't care, which was really annoying. Because I went through all this for somebody who didn't care. But I handed her the nutrient bar, which she ate because she hadn't had lunch. Now, this is my mind. I'm afraid to tell the whole truth. And I'm risking very little. So we all lie. We're all protecting something inside, all of us. So how could we be that shocked when other people lie to us? Like, until we're clean, how can we be shocked? You think about that. How can we be shocked that somebody has mistreated us when we go to bed perfectly fine at night, knowing that a billion people will not eat tonight, and it doesn't disturb our sleep at all? So with that kind of callous indifference, what world are we expecting to never, ever be unkind to us? Like, what world is that? I don't know what that world is. I'm just talking about how you have to take a somewhat slightly honest appraisal of yourself before you get so outraged that other people are like you, maybe in different ways and in different forms. But we have to be very careful. Now, the truth is we need to forgive us all for being human and being saddled by a sense of self that is very, very, very delicate and dangerous. That ego thing that we construct, this personality that we construct, is a very treacherous friend because it is over-interested in us and under-interested in the rest of the planet. So it allows us to get really pissed off when somebody cuts us off in the freeway where nothing happens and 4 seconds later it's over, but go to sleep fine in a world that distributes its resources in a way that 1 billion people have no food. That's our personality. That's our ego structure that is so overwhelmingly over-focused on self and under-focused on both the harm we do and the pain that other people are experiencing, that we can hold on to grudges for years when the world has moved on, when we have harmed other people, and many, 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 many worse things cry for our attention, cry out for it. This is the human dilemma. It's the human problem. We over-examine this body, this form. We're over-attached to it. We worry about it too much, and we defend it too much, which causes us to not see the suffering that is all over the place. All over. And not be empathic and compassionate and sensitive towards it, but oversensitive to ours, where we become bitter and mistrusting. This is the human problem that people like me are trying in our tiny little way to unravel a little bit, just a little bit. And one of the things that I have found in my work is there's two parts to it. One, there's my knowledge, whatever it is, humor, conversation, and there's your receptivity. And I found that both are important. One of the things that I learned, and I'm just being clear about this, is I've learned that many people who come to forgiveness talks, some of them are there to learn how to forgive. Some of them are there to rebut the idea of forgiveness. Some people want to hold on to their grudges, and some people don't. It's a very interesting thing, because in an audience or in a class, some people will come in hostile. What's this guy doing talking about forgiveness? He never met my mother-in-law. That's what I get. Or he never met my ex-husband. That's the biggest one. Seriously, I've been doing forgiveness work for 20 years. By far and away, the largest category of any issue that comes up at all is, boy, did I have a bad ex-husband. That is by far and away the largest catchment of forgiveness. And the reason is very simple. In an intimate relationship, we're at our most vulnerable and our most raw. And we let down our guard and we unlock some of the defenses we have against our personality being seen. We let somebody in. And when they come in and act a little bit like a bull in a china shop, it really hurts. It really hurts. And that wound, if it's on top of attachment wounds from childhood or losses from childhood, cuts really deeply. And unfortunately, people respond to that wound with anger rather than softness. Softness may actually heal the wound. Anger protects the wound from being seen. It says, I'm angry with you. I am unable to feel my vulnerability. It is too frightening. When it is too frightening, I have to keep it at bay. And so in my mind, I punish you and I push you away. all of this, and this is one of the lessons that I have learned, and I know she's going to stop in a minute to give a break. I'm going to do a practice or two after this, just a forgiveness kind of practice. But the key, one of the key learnings besides the wall we put around our ego in person is in order to get over stuff, we have to become softer to feel the pain and open back up to life's goodness, not harden against the pain. And so much of unforgiveness is our hardening against the pain. And so much of what we do is to not admit how vulnerable we are, how hurtable we are, and at some level how scared we are. You know, that we can be damaged. Okay, you wanted to... She told me to stop at 6:30.
We would like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to Forgive for Good with Dr. Fred Luskin.
That was short.
Wasn't even a bathroom break. So let me get a little bit at the receptivity of the audience, because the softer you are and the quieter your breathing are and the less adrenaline you have in your body, the more likely it is you will touch the place in you that has either some willingness or interest in forgiving. And it doesn't matter what it is that you're forgiving. But when we are tight, when there's tension in our muscles, when there's adrenaline circulating in our system to protect us from danger, it's very hard to allow the neurochemistry that we know is forgiveness. Because forgiveness, while it could be a spiritual quality, it could be a heart quality, it could be all sorts of qualities, we know it because of the thoughts. I'm not there anymore. I'm okay. I'm not angry. I don't feel like a victim. I'm okay. Those are thoughts. We need to have a body that can have those thoughts. If you have a tight nervous system, every time you think of someone that harmed you, you can't have the thoughts of forgiveness, even if you want them. You can't have thoughts of compassion, even if you want them. You have to be able to unclench. So what I'm going to ask you all to do is, just while you're sitting here, take about two or three slow, deep breaths. Just slow, deep breaths. You don't have to close your eyes, but you can. Just take two or three slow, deep breaths. And what I would like you to do is, if you're able, is relax your abdomen while you're breathing. This is the key to releasing adrenaline. Relax your belly. Relax it. Breathe, and this is the key. Breathe as if you're safe, that nobody's going to come here and harm you, that you're okay, that you're safe enough to relax your body in a way that only people who feel safe can do. Otherwise, your belly stays constricted, your shoulders are tight, and you don't get the benefit of deeper breathing. So it's a cognitive piece of, I'm safe, I'm okay. I'm just sitting here in a room, nobody's going to harm me, and I'm okay in me. So there's enough goodness here for me to relax my abdomen, which no animal will ever do if they're under danger. Most of us carry the danger with us. So we sit in a way where we're never relaxed, never. Our shoulders are tight, our chest is tight, our stomach is held tight. So we never relax. So we don't oxygenate the brain in a way that allows the intelligence of positiveness to emerge. And it's a vast intelligence, vast, of which forgiveness is just a little piece. So I'd like you to see if you can breathe as if you're fine, like just as you are. You're just fine. Like, you don't need anything else right now to be okay. And you're breathing in a way to manifest that that's true. You're okay. And that breath is slow, and it's deep, and it's gentle. And so you're preparing yourself, if you want it, for an emotional response that's slow and deep and gentle. And you can do this anytime. Create an emotional response that's slower and deeper and gentler. And then what I'd like you to do, again, this is the simplest of practices, is bring an image to your mind of someone you adore. Just bring a crisp, clear image to your mind of someone you absolutely adore. And I'd like you to feel that you adore them as you sit here. Just feel it. Feel it in your body. Oops. Feel it. Just feel. Allow your cells to feel that you adore someone. And allow yourself to relax into being safe. When you bring your mind to goodness, when you hold goodness, when you're willing to feel goodness, then you send signals to your brain that says life is good, and I don't have to be so scared or angry right now. So I can relax. And when you relax, believe it or not, you open up into an intelligence that is kept from us when we're vigilant or hurried or tense or afraid. And it's a vast intelligence of goodness, just vast. And that intelligence in you already knows how to forgive. It's just you have to listen to it. You even have to know it's there, and then you have to look for it. But it's not in the person who hurt you. It's not in the past. To me, it has nothing to do with any religion. It's the vast goodness that we can all touch in us. Vast. And we can cultivate the wisdom of that. You can cultivate it. So it starts by reminding yourself that you're safe and that you're okay and that you love. That you love. And even that you are loved. And so you start to, by that kind of practice, relax the adrenaline that we've been living on and fueled by. The hurry we're all in. The impatience. The anxiety. The sense that we're not enough. And so this allows you to just touch for a moment the part of you that is enough, that could forgive. And I'm going to ask you to start just by thinking of what, again, is one absolutely tiny thing that I've been holding against somebody I like. We're not even going to get to somebody you don't like, but somebody you like. What's something that I have held, that I have brought up, or complained about to somebody else that's still in my brain somewhere, holding me back. What's something that you can commit to absolutely letting go right now? And find something. You know, it could be against your partner or your parents or your children. Maybe they didn't call last Sunday or whatever. Who knows? Or maybe they called twice and you only want them to call once. Human beings create grudges against everything, literally everything. Some people because they don't like their in-laws because they never call. Other people because their in-laws are over all the time. Some people don't like the fact that their boss is too strict. Other people don't like the fact that their boss is too loose. We find reasons to be resentful in all sides of equations. All sides. And sometimes we're good enough to be resentful about both sides of the same equation. Those are the really talented folks. Those are the ones that you don't want to be stuck in an elevator with too long. You know what I mean? But let something go. Let something go. Let something go. And then find within you the behavioral imperative that will make sure you let it go. So say to yourself, I'll never complain about this again. I'll never bring it up. I will never use it. I promise myself that I don't need ever to go here again. You are excising neuronal connections that you don't need. This is somebody you care for. And even if you got nothing more out of this talk than just to do this occasionally with people you love, you'd have a better life. Because you'd be less of a pain in the ass to them. You would be, because you'd be nicer. You'd create a better environment for other people to be close to you. So that is one of the simplest forgiveness practices. Quiet down. Quiet down. Relax. And then ask yourself, what is something I just don't need? What's a piece? A little piece. Excuse me. You can build on this. But it's something, and here's the key piece. You have to practice. That's the bad news. No, it really is bad news. Because if you don't cultivate positive practices, then the tendency of all of us to have negative practices will take precedence. So you are going to be grouchy a lot. That's just dint of being a human being with a very primitive nervous system. You're going to find things wrong in this world. So that can't necessarily be stopped as easily as you might hope. What you can do is constantly look for things to balance that. That you can constantly do. Unfortunately, your brain is wired. I mean, my brain too, but our brain is wired so that negative experiences have really wide, well-myelinated pathways. And positive experiences, these little narrow, bumpy things that barely get the signals through. Because the negative experiences you need to save your life, and you can live a wretched, miserable, long life without positiveness, but you can do it. So you have to practice. It's very interesting. You have to practice. You know, the spiritual tradition suggests that you meditate or pray on a regular basis because you have to practice. Any good has to be practiced. You don't exercise once, pat yourself on the back, and go to Baskin and Robbins. I mean, you could do that, but you won't get much from it. right? You have to practice. Okay, one more simple practice of forgiveness. So here's what I'd like you to do. I'd like you to think, it's along the same lines, I'd like you to think of someone close to you that you have harmed in some way. I don't want it to be a catastrophic harm because you got 6 minutes for this for the rest of my talk, so I don't want anybody running out of here screaming because they remember all the worst things that they did. Pick something where you harmed somebody close to you, but it's no more than like a 5 on a scale of 10. So the simplest stuff to remember is all the times that you didn't pay attention when they needed you. Those are harms. The times when you're too busy, too preoccupied, watching the Warriors, whatever it is. You know, somebody comes in crying last night and you're saying, well, honey, there's 5 minutes left in the game. Right? That's what I did. Think of someone you harmed that you really care about. Okay? And picture something that hurt them. Not devastatingly, but hurt them. Now, I'd ask you to all to close your eyes. Please close your eyes. And I'm going to ask you now, in your mind, say the following. Wait till I have finished. I love you. I'm sorry. Please forgive me. I love you. I'm sorry. Please forgive me. Now make sure you say this 3 times in your mind. I love you. I'm sorry. Please forgive me. Just in your mind. I love you. I'm sorry. Please forgive me. And now what I'd like you to do is bring your attention to the area around your heart. And make the words emerge as if they're in your heart, that you're feeling them in your heart. I love you. I'm sorry. Please forgive me. As if your heart is saying it. I love you. I'm sorry. Please forgive me. And now one last thing, I want you to form the words on your lips so you say them, but there's no real vocalization. You just say, not out loud, but you're going to make the vocalization on your lips. I love you. I'm sorry. Please forgive me. I love you. I'm sorry. Please forgive me. I love you. I'm sorry. Please forgive me. And then just let that go. Take a slow, deep breath into and out of your belly, and then allow your eyes to open. Now, I gave you 2 incredibly simple forgiveness practices. Incredibly simple. But they both involve some degree, and I need to repeat this, of you calming down. So when I work or conceptualize forgiveness, I know that there's a vast goodness that's available for us to tap into. I know that because I've seen people who have experienced unbelievably horrific things tap into it. I've tapped into it myself, and I believe it resides in our brain, or at least our brain gives us access to it. I've seen it with so many people that empirically I know it's so. I can't swear to it. But when we calm down and we open our hearts just a little bit, then we're okay thinking more gracious and generous thoughts. That just happens. Most of us fly to Hawaii to get that experience. You can just sit at home, but you can go to Hawaii. And that's the whole commercialization of vacation. It's because you finally feel safe enough to relax. You don't have to go to work. You're not in your familiar triggered environment, right? But that's all you're doing is tapping into the part of you that's safe and willing to experience the abundance that life offers. That's all you're doing when you go to Hawaii. You know, I realized this, and it was a very rich experience for me. About 2 years ago, I went to Bali, and it was beautiful, but it is a long trip. I mean, it was a long trip. And I remember going to this really beautiful hotel on the Indian Ocean, and I thought to myself, okay, I just spent one full day getting here. Now, that's strange. Like, I gave up a whole day to go here when I live 4 minutes from the ocean. Okay, so that was one thought. But it's gorgeous here. And yes, it's beautiful. But then I said to myself, you know, the Buddha, yoga, they started in places that were right up against the Indian Ocean. And they had lots of suffering and difficulty that they had to deal with. So why did I bring myself 10,000 miles to think that this beauty is any better than the beauty I have in Santa Cruz or right here? It was only because I had convinced myself that I needed to go somewhere to find beauty and then open myself to that beauty so I could feel good. And that was the point. And then I just thought, well, it's a beautiful spot, but I don't need this. I don't need to spend 24 hours in a plane to find beauty. It's everywhere. But it's the fact that it's inside of us. See, that's the thing that I want to leave you with. That we have receptors and neurotransmitters and electrical signaling and ways that the heart functions that give us access to deep wisdom of positiveness. This is beautiful. This is good. They made a mistake. It's okay. I made a mistake. The world will survive. Let me just make nice. It all it comes from the same place in us. So what I found being a forgiveness teacher is the only thing that I really have to do is try to help people find that place in them through practice and stop practicing so much the things that take them away from that place. That's the whole thing. So if you're practicing resentment, then you're never going to touch that place. If you're practicing bitterness, if you say to yourself 10 times every week, my parents ruined my life, well, they ruined your life. And you're going to trigger the parts of your brain that have no goodwill available to them. So what I came to understand is most of this is practice. Where we place our attention, what we're open to, and do we have any trust in our own goodness, in our own capacity to feel safe enough, loved enough, connected enough, where we can then give that generosity out. I mean, that's all forgiveness is. It's touching the place in you where you're safe and okay, so you don't have to punish something for taking you away from that place. That's what I understood. Anyway, I thank you. I know she's coming up with some questions, and I have about 10 minutes to answer your questions. So thank you.
Well, you can get water out of this.
Thanks to Dr. Leskin.
That's me.
That's right. I'm going to say his name over and over again. Have a seat. Right. And I think we will have some questions now. I haven't had a chance to preview them, but I ask you to be real legible. You want to take them? Well, you take some and I'll take some.
Isn't there a fine line between forgiveness, forgiving someone, and being a pushover? I don't think the line is that fine. It's a big line. At some level, forgiveness and being a pushover have almost nothing in common, because part of forgiveness, what makes this such a strong, deep quality, is you have to acknowledge that you were wronged. Forgiveness acknowledges that a wrong was done, that you've been harmed, and that you or somebody else failed at some human experience. So it's not denial, it's not like minimizing, it's seeing life clearly. It is, it's seeing life clearly, and then recognizing that part of the process is how long you need to recognize this harm. Both because there are so many other people suffering and you have a reasonably short life which you don't want to miss. So the pushover piece has literally nothing to do with forgiveness. Now, the one thing that I will say is some of the capacity to forgive, one of the useful like accompaniments to it is learning to be appropriately assertive. You know, it is not useful to just let, whenever possible, people do what they want without you saying, hey, no. Okay, that's one. Since we live in a culture where individual differences are highly valued, example given reality TV. That's interesting. That wouldn't have been the way I describe individual differences, but how do we create forgiveness in a larger scale? You know, that question is one that we're all asking about all human goodness. Like, what do we do to make this like a better world for us? So clearly, there's some necessity of bottom-up growth, which means the small things that individuals can do in their daily life, bottom-up, small practices, you know. Yes, I can let you get ahead of me. I'm not in a hurry. If you're in Whole Foods and you knock me over to get to the item because you're in such a hurry, because you're busy and you have 17 kids and whatever it is, and you forget that you're in this abundant temple, I can forgive you. Those are bottom up. We also need top down. We need exemplars and leaders and people speaking it. You know, one of the things that I learned many years ago when the Amish, those murders happened at Nickel Mines of those little girls. I was asked a number of times, like, how is that possible that the community forgave it? And I didn't know, but I got to talk to people who did know. And what they said was interesting, that the Amish had created a culture where forgiveness was important. So the heroes that they learned about in school were people who forgave. They didn't learn about the Wild West where people shot each other as their heroes. And their movies weren't, again, I'm not making right or wrong about this, you know, where people could go and create vengeance. Their heroes in their culture were those who were turn the other cheek kind of people. So
so much of it is what we create as our culture, both from the bottom up and the top down. Unfortunately, it's very, very hard to make change just from the bottom up. It's possible, but it's harder. And the very simple thing that I learned in that was when we did some work in Northern Ireland, we did some work with both sides, where both people from Catholic and Protestant sides had family members murdered. But when they went back into their culture, it was almost impossible to hold on to the gains. The people who ran exchange programs with Palestinian and Israeli youth found that when the people went back to the communities, the gains went away. And so it is very challenging to create change culture-wide.
Okay, which one? Isn't forgiveness more accessible and perhaps more powerful with a spiritual life? Must we be afraid of the G word? And then they put God underneath, just in case I didn't get it. That was really sweet of whoever wrote this. You know, that's a complex answer. Because the answer is yes, if the spiritual life is one with practice. So when people self-identify as being religious, but don't do the actual practices of the religion, then it does not make them more spiritual. So they can say that, yes, I'm Christian or I'm Muslim and I go to church. That is not sufficient. You have to do some of the internal practices, whatever they might be, prayer, higher power, meditation, gentleness, forgiveness, compassion, honesty, whatever you want to do, or the 12-step programs, take a fearless inventory. You have to do something. So this is the answer, generally speaking, when people have intrinsic and extrinsic religiosity, which is intrinsic is the inner practices, extrinsic is they go somewhere or self-identify. When those are together, generally speaking, those people live lives that we would consider more spiritual. The only caveat for that involves whether they view their God as a forgiving or a vengeful God. People who view their God as forgiving and loving, they tend to be more forgiving and to get benefit in a certain way from that. Those that view their God as vengeful tend to have worse health outcomes and to suffer more emotionally. So, how do you practice true forgiveness with also respecting your feelings and experiences? That's a good question. It's a sequential thing. First, you respect your feelings and experiences. Then you hope that some of those will change so you can forgive. So if your feeling is one of resentment, bitterness, self-pity, despair, those are legitimate. And those are necessary, proximate to an injury. They're necessary. It's just that you hope or you want to engender a change in those feelings and experiences, so you don't have to carry that garbage around with you. So yes, if your husband or wife does something awful for 6 months or a year, generally 6 months of negative complaining and arguing and telling everybody what kind of a bum they are is a really helpful thing. It's just that after a while, it starts being crippling to you. So you want to both honor your feelings, but know and hope that you're also going to have to work to changing them.
Okay, check these out.
Okay.
Unfortunately, we have reached the point in our program where there is time for only one last question.
Well, I'm going to answer both of these because they're so quick. How about if you only think you might have hurt someone, but you're not sure? Ask them.
There are many definitions of forgiveness. What is the best definition of forgiveness? The one that we use is making peace with things that didn't work out the way you hoped. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Luskin. It was great to have you here. We appreciate it. We also thank our audiences here, as well as those listening in at the recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 112th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.